Hello again, and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the April 19th to April 25th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration reminiscent of the classic interstellar alien illustration, the long face, large blank eyes, gaping mouth, hands, or whatever they are, held up on either side. In this version, however, the long face is a bag, the kind of bag that money might be transported in, upside down and tied at the opening at the bottom. The eyes are wide open, with eyebrows raised, and the mouth is a dollar sign. The headline, How a Dollar Crisis Would Unfold. The cover leader, Biting the Hand That Funds, How a Dollar Crisis Would Unfold. If investors keep selling American assets, a grim fate awaits the world economy. That article will be followed by five additional leader section articles, starting with, In Pursuit of a Policy, Donald Trump's Government is Content to Destroy a Man. What's at stake in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia? Then, Swipe It Away, Zuckerberg on Trial, Why Meta Deserves to Win. Social media has plenty of problems. Lack of competition isn't one of them. Then the rule of law. Brazil's Supreme Court is on trial. How a superstar judge illuminates an excessive concentration of power. And then leader number five will be In Praise of Plastics. Don't overlook the many benefits of plastics. If they are a problem, it's because they are badly managed. And then finally, Something Rotten, the lesson of Birmingham's striking bin men. The moment is ripe to reform Britain's equal pay rules. Then we'll move to the United States section for By the Numbers, Tracking Donald Trump's Immigration Crackdown, and why that is increasingly hard to do. And then, time permitting, from the science and technology section, Well Informed, electric vehicles also cause pollution. Though fume-free, their brake pads and tires disintegrate over time. So, that is the lineup. We'll go back to the top for the cover leader. Biting the Hand That Funds, How a Dollar Crisis Would Unfold. If investors keep selling American assets, a grim fate awaits the world economy. The dollar is meant to be a source of safety. Lately, however, it has been a cause of fear. Since its peak in mid-January, the greenback has fallen by over 9% against a basket of major currencies. Two-fifths of that fall has happened since April 1st, even as the yield on 10-year treasuries has crept up by 0.2 percentage points. That mix of rising yields and a falling currency is a warning sign. If investors are fleeing even though returns are up, it must be because they think America has become more risky. Rumors are rife that big foreign asset managers are dumping greenbacks. For decades, investors have counted on the stability of American assets, making them the keystones of global finance. The depth of a $27 trillion market helps make treasuries a haven. The dollar dominates trade in everything from goods and commodities to derivatives. The system is buttressed by the Federal Reserve, which promises low inflation, and by America's sturdy governance, under which foreigners and their money have been welcome and secure. In just a few weeks, President Donald Trump has replaced these ironclad assumptions with stomach-churning doubts. This crisis in the making was created in the White House. Mr. Trump's reckless trade war has raised tariffs by roughly a factor of 10 and created economic uncertainty. Once the envy of the world, America's economy is now courting recession as tariffs rupture supply chains, boost inflation, and punish customers. This comes as America's historically bad fiscal position is becoming even worse. Net debts stand at about 100% of GDP. The budget deficit over the past year of 7% was astonishingly high for a healthy economy. Yet, in its quest to renew and extend tax cuts from Mr. Trump's first term, Congress wants to borrow still more. On April 10th, it approved a budget blueprint that could add $5.8 trillion in deficits over the next decade, according to the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a think tank. That would boost the deficit by another 2 percentage points and exceeds the combined total value of Mr. Trump's first-term tax cuts, the extra spending in the COVID-19 pandemic, and Joe Biden's stimulus and infrastructure bills. It could double the pace at which the debt-to-GDP ratio rises in the coming years. What makes this economic downturn and the loss of fiscal discipline so explosive is the fact that markets are starting to doubt whether Mr. Trump can govern competently or consistently. The shambolic, incoherent way the tariffs were calculated, unveiled, and delayed was a mockery of policymaking. On-again, off-again exemptions and sectoral tariffs promote lobbying. For decades, America has carefully signaled its dedication to a strong dollar. Today, some White House advisors are talking about the reserve currency as if it were a burden to be shared, using coercion if necessary. Inevitably, this puts the Federal Reserve under strain. Mr. Trump is pressing the central bank to cut interest rates. The courts are likely to stop him sacking Fed governors at will, but he will be able to nominate a new pliant Fed chair in 2026. Meanwhile, the president's other policies, such as shipping undocumented migrants to El Salvador without a hearing, or harassing law firms that displease him, make it possible to think that foreign creditors' rights could suffer. All this has created a risk premium for American assets. The shocking thing is that a full-blown bond market crisis is also easy to imagine. Foreigners own $8.5 trillion of government debt, a bit under a third of the total. More than half of that is held by private investors, who cannot be cajoled by diplomacy or threatened with tariffs. America must refinance $9 trillion of debt over the next year. If demand for treasuries weakens, the impact will quickly feed through to the budget, which, owing to high debts and short maturities, is sensitive to interest rates. What would Congress do then? When markets collapsed during the global financial crisis and the pandemic, it acted forcefully. But those crises required it to spend, not to impose cuts. This time it would need to take an axe to entitlements and raise taxes quickly. You need only consider the makeup of Congress and the White House to see that the markets might have to impose a lot of pain before the government could agree on what to do. As America dithered, the shock could spread from treasuries to the rest of the financial system, bringing defaults and hedge fund blow-ups. That is the sort of behavior you would expect in an emerging market. The Fed, for its part, would face a painful dilemma. It could buy assets to steady the ship, but it would not want to appear to be monetizing the debt of an uncreditworthy government, an especially risky move when inflation is high. Could it strike the balance between emergency lending and monetary financing? And if it was not bailing out Mr. Trump, would he approve of it lending dollars to foreign central banks that lack liquidity, as it usually does in a crisis? A currency is only as good as the government that backs it. The longer America's political system fails to grapple with its deficits or flirts with chaotic or discriminatory rules, the more likely will be a once-in-a-generation upheaval that pushes the global financial system into the unknown. Wherever things settled, the greenback's diminished role would be a tragedy for America. True, some exporters would benefit from a weaker currency. But the dollar's primacy reduces the cost of capital for everyone, from first-time homebuyers to blue-chip firms. Biting the hand that funds. The world would suffer because the dollar has no equal, just pale imitations. The euro is backed by a big economy, but the eurozone does not produce enough safe assets. Switzerland is safe, but small. Japan is big, but has its own vast debts. Gold and cryptocurrencies lack stake backing. As investors tried one asset and then another, the hunt for safety could bring about destabilizing booms and busts. The dollar system is not perfect, but it provides the stable ground on which today's globalized economy is built. When investors doubt America's creditworthiness, those foundations are in danger of cracking. That was the cover leader, Biting the Hand That Funds, how a dollar crisis would unfold. If investors keep selling American assets, a grim fate awaits the world economy. And we'll move on now to leader article number 2. In pursuit of a policy, Donald Trump's government is content to destroy a man. What's at stake in the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia? Kilmar Abrego Garcia moved to America illegally when he was 16. His lawyers say his parents sent him north after a gang in El Salvador threatened to kidnap him and rape his sisters. 8 years after coming to America, he was detained while looking for work in a Home Depot car park. Maryland's police thought he might be a gang member, though that claim was never tested in court. His case was heard by an immigration judge, who denied Mr. Abrego Garcia's asylum claim. But the judge ruled that he could not be deported because he had a well-founded fear of persecution, and so he was released. This is how the law works in America. It can be slow, evidence is not always clear, and judgments can frustrate everyone. Then the law broke down. In defiance of that ruling, Mr. Abrego Garcia was deported to El Salvador in March without a trial or a chance to appeal and put in a prison that specializes in the degrading treatment of alleged gang members. Then the Trump administration said it had made a mistake. The Supreme Court issued a 9-0 ruling that the federal government should, quote, facilitate his return to America. A few days later, Nayib Bukele, El Salvador's president, appeared in the Oval Office and was asked about Mr. Abrego Garcia. He could not possibly return a, quote, terrorist to the United States, he said. President Trump, usually quick to assert his power over others, smiled as if to say, I would so like to obey the Supreme Court, but what can you do? Governments have the right to deport people who migrate illegally. Mr. Trump promised a campaign of mass deportation, and voters gave him a mandate to carry it out. In Mr. Abrego Garcia, the administration has picked a soft target, an illegal immigrant, tainted by the allegation of being a gang member. He will not command the sympathy of many Americans. As a non-citizen, he does not enjoy the full panoply of protections. Even so, Mr. Abrego Garcia does have rights, and by trampling them, Mr. Trump is undermining the rule of law. Many of America's freedoms were established by plaintiffs whom the majority condemned. The right to free expression of every church-going Midwesterner is underpinned by court rulings in favor of a Ku Klux Klan leader in Brandenburg versus Ohio, a pornographer, Hustler magazine versus Falwell, and a man who burned an American flag outside a Republican convention, Texas versus Johnson. The courts upheld their rights and thereby secured the rights of everyone else. The Trump administration is turning this idea on its head. In addition, the administration cannot deny someone the protection of the courts just because they are not a citizen. Even the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, site of the worst abuse of domestic liberties ordered by the White House this century, could appeal to a judicial process of sorts. Mr. Abrego Garcia had expressly been spared from deportation to El Salvador. Mr. Trump's grin mocked the principle that America is a place where the government cannot suspend rights whenever it chooses, and where the head of government willingly defers to the highest court. In other words, that America is not El Salvador. Last, Mr. Abrego Garcia's case shows that the Trump administration is prepared to destroy a man's life in pursuit of its policies. The right not to be locked up indefinitely without trial, or habeas corpus, is absolute and a fundamental principle by which people can limit the arbitrary exercise of state power. Even by the time of Thomas Jefferson's first inaugural address, it had existed in common law for centuries. Jefferson called it one of the elements forming a, quote, bright constellation that had guided the young nation through revolution and reformation. That is still true. But as long as Mr. Abrego Garcia remains in El Salvador's terrorism confinement center, that constellation will be dimmed, and Americans should worry. That was Leader Article number 2. In its pursuit of a policy, Donald Trump's government is content to destroy a man. What's at stake in the case of Kilmer Abrego Garcia? And we'll move on to Leader Article number 3. Swipe it away. Zuckerberg on trial. Why Meta deserves to win. Social media has plenty of problems. Lack of competition isn't one of them. The $23 million house that Mark Zuckerberg bought last month in Washington, D.C., is a 7-bathroom testament to Meta's devotion to lobbying. As well as donating $1 million to Donald Trump's presidential inauguration fund, and shelling out $25 million to settle a spurious lawsuit from the president, Meta has magnified its board, appointing allies such as Dana White and, last week, Dina Powell, who served in Mr. Trump's first administration. And here it is noted, parenthetically, that John Elkin, the boss of Exor, which part owns The Economist's parent company, is also a director. Mr. Zuckerberg has dined at Mar-a-Lago and visited the White House. The reason for this frantic schmoozing is a blockbuster antitrust trial that began on April 14th and which threatens to break up Mr. Zuckerberg's $1.3 trillion empire. The stakes are high, and the politics are low. But what matters is that the claim the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, America's competition watchdog, has brought against Meta deserves to fail. The complaint, launched in 2020, alleges that Meta, then called Facebook, illegally maintained its social media monopoly when it bought Instagram and WhatsApp, two smaller rivals, several years earlier. Though the FTC approved both transactions at the time, it now wants them undone. To establish that Meta is a monopolist, the trustbusters have described its market as, quote, personal social networking. This is a tendentially narrow definition that excludes obvious rivals such as X, LinkedIn, Pinterest, and Reddit. On this view, the world's biggest social media company competes only with Snapchat, a much smaller rival, and MeWe, an even tinier one. The FTC's argument was never compelling, and in the years since the complaint was filed, it has only become less persuasive. Despite the FTC's claim that network effects create insurmountable barriers to entry, the past few years have seen a rush of successful social media startups. Some have fizzled, like Clubhouse and Be Real. Others remain small, such as Blue Sky and Mr. Trump's own Truth Social. But the arrival of TikTok, which has attracted more than 1.5 billion users worldwide, makes a mockery of the idea that the market is closed. Competition has intensified in other ways, too. Thanks partly to TikTok's innovation, social apps now revolve around video. That has pitched Meta into competition with giants such as YouTube, whose Shorts feature mimics the TikTok-like vertical clips that also play on Facebook and Instagram. Moreover, once distinct media markets are converging. Spotify, originally a music service, is pushing into video. Roblox, a gaming platform, acts as a social network for many teenagers. As competition spreads across previously separate categories, the FTC's narrow market definition looks even sillier. What of the experience for consumers, whose interests the FTC exists to defend? The regulator argues that a shortage of competition has created worse products, citing an overload of ads on Meta's apps. But the idea that consumers have been poorly served by the social media market in recent years is hard to square with the hours of extra time they are devoting to it. By one estimate, nearly half of all mobile screen time worldwide is spent browsing social media, and about a quarter of all waking hours are spent on phones. Ask a parent if they have any concerns about social media, and they will chew your ear off. But they are unlikely to complain that their child is short of social apps. Indeed, consumers' behavior suggests that, for better or worse, they have seldom encountered a market they find so captivating. The shaky case has come to trial at an appropriately farcical moment. As the FTC sets out its claim that Meta faces insufficient competition, the firm's main rival, TikTok, hangs in legal limbo. Distribution of the Chinese-owned app in America has been outlawed since the beginning of Mr. Trump's presidency, but he has ordered the authorities to ignore the ban for 75 days, then 150, while he negotiates the app's sale to an American buyer. No one has the faintest idea whether the app will still be around by the time Meta's trial is over. How can any serious judgment on competition in social media be made without knowing the fate of TikTok, its greatest disruptive force? What began as a thin case has become progressively weaker, and now looks downright absurd. The court should waste no time and swiping it up and away. That was Leader Article number 3, Swipe It Away, Zuckerberg on Trial, Why Meta Deserves to Win. Social media has plenty of problems. Lack of competition isn't one of them. And we'll proceed now to Leader Article number 4, The Rule of Law. Brazil's Supreme Court is on trial. How a superstar judge illuminates an excessive concentration of power. Brazilian democracy has taken a beating over the past two decades, and much of the blame lies with its rotten politicians. Every president since 2003 has been accused of breaking the law. Dilma Rousseff was impeached for fiddling public accounts. Luis Inacio Lula da Silva, known as Lula, was jailed for corruption and is now president again. Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right agitator, allegedly plotted a coup to stay in power after losing the election in 2022 and will soon be put on trial. But Brazil's democracy has another problem: judges with too much power, and no figure embodies that more than Alexandre de Moraes, who sits on the Supreme Court. His record shows that judicial power needs to be pared back. Brazil's Supreme Court has inexorably gained clout and prestige as the executive branch has lost legitimacy and Congress has been mired in gridlock and scandal. Since ruling on a big corruption case in 2012, the court has become more willing to assert its powers. Mr. Bolsonaro's dangerous, anti-democratic behavior, both in office and after being kicked out by voters, gave the court further justification to throw its weight around in defense of the rule of law. Mr. Bolsonaro allegedly tried to declare a bogus state of emergency after losing the election, and his supporters assaulted government buildings and planned to attack an airport. The latest allegations accuse him of planning to assassinate Mr. Moraes, as well as Lula and his vice president in 2022, before they could assume office. These are grave charges, and the court should weigh the evidence and convict if appropriate. The trouble is that there are mounting questions about the court's own behavior, the quality of justice it delivers, and the appropriateness of its sanctions. A panel of five judges will, for example, decide whether Bolsonaro indeed goes to jail, instead of the court's full bench of 11. Of the five, one is Lula's former personal lawyer, and another is his former justice minister. The trial thus risks reinforcing the perception that the court is guided as much by politics as by the law. During Lava Jato, or car wash, a gigantic corruption probe that ran through the 2010s, the court upheld jail sentences for dozens of politicians and businessmen found guilty of graft, but then changed its mind and nullified Lula's convictions in 2021 on procedural grounds. In 2023, the court's president boasted it had, quote, defeated Bolsonaro. Claims of such arbitrariness and impropriety have become common. In recent years, a single judge, José Antonio Díaz Toffoli, has voided almost all the evidence uncovered during Lava Jato and opened a dubious investigation into Transparency International, an anti-corruption group based in Berlin. Gilmar Mendez, another judge, hosts a flashy gathering attended by the kind of high-powered people who often have business in front of the court. Then there is Mr. Moraes. He has led investigations into Mr. Bolsonaro, but is conflicted because he has been targeted by the former president's smear and intimidation machine. He has also been waging a crusade against anti-democratic speech online, wielding astonishingly expansive powers, which has overwhelmingly targeted right-wing actors. Last year, he ordered X, a social media platform owned by Elon Musk, to take down hundreds of pro-Bolsonaro accounts, often without giving the account owners any explanation. He blocked access to X in Brazil for over a month and froze the bank accounts of Starlink, Mr. Musk's satellite internet firm. Mr. Moraes responds to criticism with imperiousness. Pressed last year about whether the court should adopt an ethics code, as the United States Supreme Court did in 2023, Mr. Moraes claimed that, quote, there isn't the slightest need. In its defense, the court is acting legally. It gains its powers from Brazil's constitution, which is one of the world's longest, and lets political parties, trade unions, and many other organizations file cases directly to the Supreme Court, rather than having them filter up from lower courts. This means that the Supreme Court, in effect, makes the law on issues that would be decided by elected officials in many other countries. A single judge can unilaterally pass rulings with serious repercussions, known as, quote, monocratic decisions. The Supreme Court often steps in because Brazil's other institutions do their job poorly. Congress has long sat on a bill that would set clear rules for online speech. Instead, surreally, it is spending its time mulling legislation that would pardon those who attacked government buildings after Mr. Bolsonaro's electoral loss. The threat from all of this is threefold. One danger is that the quality of decision-making at the Supreme Court will deteriorate as its remit sprawls relentlessly. Second, the more the court seeks to manage politics, the more it loses public support. Just 12% of people say that it is doing a good or great job, down from 31% in 2022. Third, such unconstrained power raises the threat of the court becoming an instrument of illiberal impulses that infringe on liberty, rather than support it. What can be done? Part of the answer is for the Supreme Court to exercise restraint. To restore its image of impartiality, it should convene its full bench to try Mr. Bolsonaro, including the two judges whom the former president appointed. Individual judges should avoid issuing monocratic decisions, especially on sensitive political issues. And once the trial against Mr. Bolsonaro is over, Brazil's Congress should wrest back the job of policing online speech from Mr. Moraes. Brazilians have lost faith in two of their three branches of government. It is essential to avoid a full-blown crisis of confidence in the third. You just heard Leader Article Number 4, The Rule of Law. Brazil's Supreme Court is on trial. How a superstar judge illuminates an excessive concentration of power. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the April 19th to April 25th edition of the magazine. We continue now with Leader Article Number 5, In Praise of Plastics. Don't overlook the many benefits of plastics. If they are a problem, it is because they are badly managed. Few people are more synonymous with wonder at the natural world than Sir David Attenborough, a nonagenarian television presenter. In recent years, Sir David has been campaigning fervently for an end to the plastic that his film crews find scattered across the planet. The plastic in our oceans ought never to have got there in the first place, he said in one interview. Much of it perhaps ought not to have been manufactured at all. The first statement is reasonable, but the second is not, for it disregards the extraordinary benefits that plastics and the industry which produces them have provided both to humans and to the environment. Although the drawbacks of the world's reliance on plastics are all too apparent, the benefits they provide, in the form of reducing waste and cost, are all too easily overlooked. Plastics have made possible a bewildering range of new materials that can replicate the properties of existing ones and do things they cannot, while being lighter, more durable, and cheaper and easier to manufacture. These materials have become vital in everything from building to car making to consumer electronics. Take food as an example. Plastic packaging prevents perishable foodstuffs from spoiling, making possible global trade in meat, fish, fruit, and vegetables. It enables essentials like rice, cooking oil, and powdered milk to be stored and distributed safely and cheaply. A 1 liter plastic bottle weighs 5% as much as a glass one. Plastic packaging thus reduces shipping costs and emissions. Plastics have also eased the world's reliance on older materials and on the living beings from which many of them came. There are perhaps 10 million pianos in the world. If all their white keys were made of ivory, how many elephants would remain? Just as the benefits of plastics are often unseen, however, so are some potential harms. The visible blight of discarded waste strewn across otherwise lovely landscapes, often to the detriment of wildlife, used to be one of the principal charges against plastics. Now there is growing concern about what happens when they break up into microscopic fragments invisible to the naked eye. In the past decade, such, quote, microplastics have been found in food chains, in human brains, and even in the apparently pristine snow of Antarctica. Being detectable does not make something dangerous. It can be mere testimony to the acuity of the instruments in use. But history shows that ubiquitous industrial materials can do unintended, unexpected, and widespread harm that is recognized much too late. Think of lead-based paint and leaded petrol, which cause health and developmental problems. The ubiquity of microplastics means the harm they might do deserves serious, well-supported, and coordinated research. Some worrying findings make that a matter of urgency. If there are harms, swift action will be needed on diagnosis and remediation. To deal with the scourge of pollution, the best approach is not to ban plastics, but to manage them more carefully. Better recycling technologies, now under development, are one part of the answer. The proportion of plastics which end up being recycled has doubled in the past 2 decades. But it is still only 9%. This is not because people do not care about the planet. It is because recycling is harder and more costly than most people realize. Technical difficulties and the onerous sorting required mean that recycled plastic is almost always more expensive than the virgin stuff, which makes it hard to set up a virtuously circular market. One result is that many rich countries export their waste for, quote, recycling in poorer countries, which are not equipped to deal with their own often voluminous plastic waste problems, let alone anyone else's. The UN estimates that 59% of all plastic waste ends up being sorted by roughly 20 million informal workers worldwide, frequently in terrible conditions. Greater use should therefore be made of landfill. When properly managed and well monitored, this is far less environmentally ruinous than often portrayed, and can be simpler and more effective than poorly executed recycling. It also sidesteps the risk that plastics sent across the world for recycling will be dumped or burned. Incinerators, which can both produce energy and allow the resulting carbon to be captured, are a useful option too, though they are also unpopular. Fortnum, a Finnish company, has found a way to turn the hydrocarbons released from waste incineration back into plastic feedstock. Such innovation should be built on. When it comes to plastics, the benefits are very much greater than most people will allow, and so is the potential for managing the costs. That was Leader Article number 5, in praise of plastics. Don't overlook the many benefits of plastics. If they are a problem, it is because they are badly managed. And we'll move on now to leader article number 6. Something Rotten. The lesson of Birmingham's striking bin men. The moment is ripe to reform Britain's equal pay rules. The stench alone is a metaphor. For 6 weeks, strikes by city bin collectors have blotted the streets of Birmingham with growing mounds of rubbish. The rats in Britain's second city have feasted and multiplied. More is at stake than the usual to and fro of unions hustling bosses for better pay or lighter working hours. Birmingham is the latest in a growing roster of victims hobbled by expansive equal pay laws. These penalize employers for disparities between sometimes wildly different roles. Binmen and cleaners, warehouse stockers and shop workers. If judges can be sold on the idea that the work is of, quote, equal value. Never mind whether the market concurs. The consequences are huge. Over £1 billion, or $1.3 billion, in equal pay claims have bankrupted Birmingham's council. A common sticking point is the pay for an intermediate grade of binman, the waste recycling and collection officer, which has been used as a cudgel by council-employed carers and cleaners, jobs that skew towards female workers, to demand a payout. The council wants to stave off future claims by eliminating the role. Winning a case on the grounds of equal value does not require proving sexism, even the subliminal kind. It hinges instead on a sort of judicial central planning. A recent judgment against Asda, a grocery chain, dissected workdays by the minute. Ms. Darville, in the shop, handled fireworks, a known hazard. Occasionally, she mopped up a spill. Mr. Deveney, in the warehouse, spent 3% of his time tidying. Each job gets points, which sum to a value. If the judge's score doesn't match the market wage the role commands, and the gender balance is even moderately askew, there will be trouble. The Asda case has further to go, but the company may be on the hook for a £1.2 billion payout and a £400 million in extra annual wage costs, a 15% increase. A rethink is long overdue. Britain did not originally recognize, quote, equal value. Barbara Castle, the labor minister who introduced the Equal Pay Act in 1970, thought it too woolly. But it caught on across the English Channel and was added to the law books in the 1980s, under pressure from Brussels. Trouble began in the 2000s, after a ruling in the late 1990s by the European Court of Justice, which let victors claim 6 years of back pay, making a win more lucrative. Alongside Britain's relaxed rules about no-win, no-fee lawyers and higher levels of pay transparency, that proved a potent lure. Cue a bonanza. One law firm, Lee Day, is orchestrating equal pay claims against 70% of British grocery chains by market share. A rent-seeking cabal of equal pay advisors, evaluators, and lawyers has sprung up. Firms realize that subcontracting hiring allows them to elude liability. Conservative-run councils, with fewer ideological hang-ups, have done so. Left-wing ones have struggled. Labor-led Sheffield also has an ongoing dispute, and Glasgow, under the Scottish National Party, has agreed to pay out £770 million. Now the government is consulting on plans to close that escape hatch by stretching the rules to cover outsourced workers. Politicians have let the issue fester. Even Unite, the Binmen's union, is too skittish to admit where the real issue lies. Bewailing austerity is safer than wrestling with whether equal pay rules have gone too far. Brexit has given Britain a chance to fix this. Instead of doubling down on equal value, the government should ditch it and, like America, focus on people doing similar jobs. Even jobs with a history of gender bias have gradually been getting more balanced. The warehouse staff at Next, another retailer hit by an equal value ruling, is 47% female. Defining equal value less broadly and reining in the scale of payouts would also work. Europe should learn from Britain's troubles. The European Commission is due to push through new pay transparency rules in 2026, which will make equal value cases far easier to bring. Birmingham is an hour's flight from Brussels. Eurocrats would do well to take a walking tour of Birmingham's bins, though they should mind where they tread. That was the sixth and final leader article in this issue of the magazine, Something Rotten, the lesson of Birmingham's striking binmen. The moment is ripe to reform Britain's equal pay rules. And we'll move over now to the United States section for By the Numbers, tracking Donald Trump's immigration crackdown, and why that is increasingly hard to do. Kilmar Abrego Garcia was not supposed to be sent back to El Salvador. He came to America illegally around 2011 as a teenager, but had been living in Maryland legally since 2019. He is married to an American citizen, has three American children, and, with no criminal history, was ostensibly protected from deportation. Yet he is now languishing in a Salvadorian prison as one of more than 200 migrants deported without due process when Mr. Trump invoked the Alien Enemies Act last month. In the Oval Office, Nayib Bukele, El Salvador's president, said that the idea that he would return Mr. Abrego Garcia to America was, quote, preposterous, despite the Supreme Court's ruling that the Trump administration must facilitate his return. Mr. Abrego Garcia's case exemplifies the aggressive approach to immigration enforcement that Mr. Trump is taking in his second term. He has tried to orient his administration around mass deportations and a broader crackdown on immigration. Mr. Trump has succeeded at the border. Migrant encounters have fallen by 96% since they peaked in December 2023 during Joe Biden's presidency. "What you're doing with the border is remarkable," gushed Mr. Bukele. In 2022, migrant shelters in El Paso, Texas, overflowed with new arrivals. Now, migrants are rarely seen. Border Patrol trucks drive lazily through the foothills that separate El Paso from Mexico. Yet locals say that things calmed down months before Mr. Trump took office. That is reflected in the data. Crossings fell quickly when Mexico tightened enforcement and Mr. Biden restricted asylum in mid-2024. The thousands of troops Mr. Trump has stationed at the border may also act as a deterrent. Immigrant advocates in El Paso say that would-be migrants are taking a, quote, wait-and-see approach to the new administration. Illegal crossings could eventually tick up as coyotes discover new and perhaps more dangerous smuggling routes. When Mr. Trump took office, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, began posting daily arrest figures on X. That did not last long. Some immigration experts suggest that the agency stopped when it became clear that they could not sustain tallies of 1,000 or so arrests a day. An analysis from Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, or TRAC, which tracks immigration data, suggests that average daily arrests in the first few weeks of Mr. Trump's term were only slightly higher than during Mr. Biden's last year in office. but those who have been arrested are now more likely to be detained. The number of detainees plummeted during the pandemic and remained relatively low during the first half of Mr. Biden's administration. This has now reversed. As of March 23rd, ICE was holding nearly 48,000 migrants. Mr. Trump is running out of places to put people. Limited detention beds can slow deportations, so ICE is working with private prison firms to reopen old jails, and with the Defense Department on plans to detain thousands at a military base in El Paso. The big question, how many deportations have actually occurred, is hard to answer. Under Mr. Biden, the Office of Homeland Security Statistics released monthly figures on immigration enforcement, including deportations. No new data have been published since January. A generous interpretation of the pause is that the Trump administration merely wants to audit its statistics, says Austin Coker, an immigration expert at Syracuse University. A more concerning interpretation, he adds, is that they are just yanking data entirely so that there is no way to fact-check what the White House says. That was an article from the United States section, By the Numbers, Tracking Donald Trump's Immigration Crackdown, and Why That Is Increasingly Hard to Do. We'll move now to the Science and Technology section for Well Informed. Electric vehicles also cause air pollution. Though fume-free, their brake pads and tires disintegrate over time. People are dying for clean air. According to the most recent estimates from the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, air pollution caused 4.7 million early deaths worldwide in 2021, about the same as dementia, road traffic accidents, malaria, and suicides combined. Road traffic is a leading contributor to dirty air. In London, for instance, it is responsible for 60% of outdoor particulate dust. Electric vehicles, or EVs, are often preferred because they can be powered by clean, sustainable energy sources and, in contrast to petrol and diesel cars, produced no exhaust fumes. But EVs nevertheless emit other pollutants common to all cars, particles originating not from the exhaust, but from brakes, tires, and roads. These, too, can be dangerous for human health. The most dangerous particles are those smaller than 2.5 microns in diameter, which get into the lungs and reach other organs via the bloodstream. Such dust can increase the risk of heart disease, stroke, lung disease, and cancer. According to British government statistics, 60% of road traffic particles below 10 microns do not come from the combustion, but from the gradual breakdown of tires, brake pads, and roads. In addition to being less well regulated than exhaust fumes, non-exhaust particles are also less well studied. That is changing. One study published in February by researchers at the University of Southampton found that some brake pad dust seems to be more damaging to dish-grown human lung cells than diesel fume particles. This was in part because of its higher levels of copper, which can damage cells and DNA. Though exact figures are elusive, scientists estimate that EVs produce more of these non-exhaust particles than other cars. This is because their batteries make them heavier, causing them to generate more friction. According to Hannah Ritchie, a data scientist at the University of Oxford, in 2023, the mean weight of an EV was 2,133 kilograms, whereas regular cars weighed around 1,500 kilograms in Britain and 1,800 kilograms in America. As cars continue to get bigger, the risk is that EVs become more polluting. Although EVs may be dirtier than you think, they are still mostly less polluting than other cars. That is partly because they use an extra braking system called regenerative braking. When the driver removes their foot from the pedal, the continued forward motion of the car is harvested to recharge the battery, thereby slowing the car down. That system works independently of brake pads, potentially eliminating one source of emissions. One study from 2021 estimated that, when regenerative braking was used for all braking, EVs produced a total of about 14 milligrams of fine particles per vehicle per kilometer on urban roads, whereas petrol cars produced about 18 and diesel cars 20, exhaust included. More radical steps can also be taken. Regulating non-exhaust emissions in a similar way to fumes would be one way to minimize the harm to human health. Encouraging people to consider smaller cars, though difficult, would be another. Enormous cars are disastrous for road safety, and most people will never need the extra range that the largest car batteries provide. Ensuring EVs run on clean electricity is also important. If their power is ultimately generated by burning coal, say, that just moves the pollution from the exhaust to the power plant chimney. Though EVs are necessary for the energy transition, they are currently far from emission-free. That was an article from the Science and Technology section. Well informed, electric vehicles also cause air pollution. Though fume-free, their brake pads and tires disintegrate over time. And speaking of time, that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the April 19th to April 25th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And as always, remember that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other Sun Sounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.